cat and mouse from your worship guides. The front of your worship guide is one of those tricky three-dimensional things that if you stare at it long enough, you will see an image that will come out from behind it. I have tried this out on several of the people in our office, and I've tried it out with several of your bulletins. It does work, and I can do it on any bulletin that you hand to me, but I realize that some of you might have a little trouble with that. And it goes to illustrate that sometimes when you look at something, there is something else there that you cannot see unless you take real time to perceive it. And it kind of leads into, it's like, oh, wow, deep. Now, excuse me, all of you with your bulletins up right now, I should have never done that, should I? It's like, okay, so I'm going to preach to the three of you that have already decided you're not doing that. Have you ever had something happen in your life that you wanted to take revenge over? And I don't mean, you know, sometimes we have things that happen in an immediate sense. My wife might say something to me, as I'm walking through, you know, the kitchen. This trash isn't gonna take itself out, you know, all by itself, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's my job, being the guy and being able to lift all, you know, 3 pounds of the trash bag. It's my job to pick that up and get it on outside and fight the elements and whatnot, and because of that, sometimes something rises up in me because I don't like being called out like that, and so she might say something like that, and I might say, "Oh, I couldn't see it behind all the dishes that are stacked up," you know, and that kind of stuff, and so, you know, we take like little verbal revenge stabs at one another, but sometimes it runs even deeper than that. Sometimes in our past, something has happened to us and it has really caused us pain. And so we hold a grudge against someone else. Something's happened, and because there is deep pain in what has happened to us, we have decided, you know what, I'm just not going to be friends with that person anymore. And we hold kind of a secret grudge against that person. And when their name comes up, perhaps in conversation, or when their name comes up around the office, we have nothing good to say. It's not that we're overtly mean about the individual, but we just pour out little seeds of discontent, and we try to get back at that person in subtle ways, in small ways, to discredit them. And we use our words and our attitudes, and our heart reveals that what we've got there is a grudge, and what we're trying to do is take out some sort of revenge. Sometimes the grudge or the hurt or the pain from the past is towards a family member. I'll tell you, nothing gets me more, gets my blood boiling more than when I feel like one of my little girls is taken advantage of by someone else. If I hear that someone treated her badly, if I hear that someone's being mean to one of my girls, that's really hard for me as a dad. And I want justice. And sometimes I want justice plus a little bit more, you know? Do you remember when some of you that are a little bit older will remember when there was a little island off the coast of South America, Grenada, and it had more sheep than it had people, and they seceded. They were a territory of Great Britain. And the people that lived on that island took it over and said, "We're breaking away from Great Britain." You know, like the United States had broken away from Great Britain. And Great Britain took umbrage at the attitude and the arrogance of a bunch of shepherds saying, "Well, this island is ours. It's not yours anymore. We're not paying you taxes. We don't need any of your help." And so what did Great Britain do? They sent part of their Atlantic fleet of ships down there, several battle cruisers and an aircraft carrier down to Grenada. It was like, what are you going to blow up? Sheep? You know, and that kind of thing. And they surrounded the island in an act of force. That's sometimes how we act, isn't it? someone does us a little bit of harm, and what do? That's it. I'm pulling out the big guns. I'm going to take out of you more than even what you've done to me. I'm going to use crushing, shock and awe kind of power on you. We take revenge. One of the odd things that happens, particularly I see this happening with parents and children, is sometimes kids are hurt by their parents. And I mean genuinely hurt. Not like, you know, my dad wouldn't let me stay out till 10 o'clock at night. But I'm talking about genuine, like, genuine issues and genuine things that happen in life. Maybe a parent was too tough, too hard. Maybe the parent even did something that was wrong against their children. And I've seen children carry grudges clear into adulthood. They use it as their excuse for the way they act. I can't stand it when people do this, that, or the other because when I was a child, my father did this or my mother did this. And they carry a deep pain and a deep hurt and a deep grudge. But something happens in the transition of being a child to becoming an adult. The roles of power will reverse. Suddenly, the parent is not the one that is so dominant over the child as that child gets older. And there becomes a place where things become kind of even. Somewhere between the end of high school and right around marriage, the roles become even. And I've seen children take out their pain on their parents by being angry and being vengeful and being mean-spirited towards them. And then in older age, I've seen children who were hurt by their parents when they were young take it out on their parents when they are the ones in a position of authority. I've seen that happen in the workplace too, where over time someone that was taken advantage of ends up being over in a superior position to someone else, and they drill on them and they take advantage of them. How many times have we seen in the news varsity junior year and senior year students who are on varsity level sports hazing freshmen? And what is their reason? Well, when we were freshmen, we were beat up on. So now that we're seniors, we're going to thump on those freshmen. And that cycle continues again and again and again. Revenge. It's part of our culture. We stick it to other people. We laugh at other people when they experience some pain that we have doled out. Why? Because you got to look out for number one, right? No one else is looking out for number one. What's it say in the Bible? God takes care of those that take care of themselves, right? No. But this is certainly the attitude of our culture. And I think it sneaks into our lives too. And I can't think of anyone that probably could have had it sneak into his life more than Joseph. See, Joseph was genuinely taken advantage of by his brothers. He may have acted arrogant. He may have acted like kind of a nitwit when he was 17 years old and just a kid. And he may have even flaunted the dreams that he was having in front of his brothers and his family. But what ended up happening to him would have left a deep and painful scar in his life. And you can bet that on that caravan ride that went from Canaan down to Egypt, you can bet that Joseph, as a 17-year-old, was probably doing what? If I ever get the opportunity to get those guys back, I am going to give it to them with everything I've got. And so God puts Joseph and Joseph's life through a series of tests, a series of reminders. We've talked about those over the past weeks. A series of tests and a series of reminders that reminded Joseph of what? It reminded him that it was God's hand that was moving in his life. To not get caught up in the circumstances that he could see and perceive, but to see behind those circumstances the hand of God at work in the midst of his life. Trusting that God and His sovereign kingly plan was at work even in the midst of Joseph's life. And God gave him many tests of this. He gave him a test with Potiphar's wife. He raised him up to a position of influence. a position of comfort in Potiphar's home, and then allowed him to drop back down into the pit of jail, like the pit that he was thrown into with his brothers. And the test there was to see whether or not Joseph would trust in God. And he passes that test, which raises him up into Pharaoh's household. So much so that during the time of fruitfulness, during the time before the famine when there was a time of fruitfulness in the land, Joseph has two children with his wife, and the first child is named to remind him that God has caused me to remember His grace and to forget my past. God has caused me to forget my past so much, it says, that I have forgotten my family. It is no longer a part of me. And he puts it behind him. His next son, that was Manasseh, his next son Ephraim, he names, and Ephraim goes on to say that, God, You've made me fruitful in the land. You've made me fruitful in this land of affliction. You get the credit, God, for what goes on in my life. But was God done testing him? No. Perhaps God has simply prepared him for what is about to happen. Because in the text, just as Joseph forgets about his past, just as his past seems to fade away, just as in the time of fruitfulness, things are going well, the famine begins. And with the famine comes perhaps one of the most dramatic tests, one of the most dramatic temptations that Joseph will ever face. So at the top of the next page, number one, letter B, as the famine becomes worse, the Egyptians begin to run out of food. And as they run out of food, Pharaoh sends them to Joseph. The famine was so devastating, it extends beyond Egypt, and it spreads to all of the known world. That's what it says down there in verse 56 of chapter 41 in Genesis. When the famine had spread over the whole face of the earth, Joseph opened all of the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. News of Egypt's abundance travels, of course, to the foreign countries, letter C, that were desperate for assistance. Joseph sold food to both Egypt and to foreigners. Look at what it says in verse 57. The people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. This would have made Egypt the sole superpower of the ancient world, the most powerful country in the region, the known world that extended up above Canaan. East, west, and south would have come to Egypt to get its food. And when they came to Egypt, who would they come to? Who would they find there? Joseph, the Hebrew, the boy that was kidnapped and then taken advantage of by Potiphar's wife and then raised up to second in the kingdom by Pharaoh himself. They would find Joseph handing out the food. Well, news arrives in Canaan. Canaan is where Jacob and his family are from. If you look on the maps that are on the back of your outline this morning, you'll see down there in the furthest southern part of the top map, or actually these are left to right, aren't they? the map that has Canaan across it, the very bottom in the south is Hebron. Hebron was where Jacob and his family lived. You'll see that there's a yellow line that extends out of Hebron and touches down at Shechem real quickly. And then up to Dothan. This was the route that Joseph took when he was searching for his brothers. But a band of Ishmaelites came from out of the east. And those Ishmaelites came through and they were also in Dothan. And Judah chirps up with his brothers and says, we want to sell Joseph to this band of Ishmaelites. Why spill his blood ourselves? And through Judah, there is redemption in Joseph's life. And he gets sold to those Ishmaelites and he proceeds down to the south. And if you jump over to the other map, you'll see that blue line extend into Egypt. And eventually, Joseph is brought down next to Cairo, Memphis, Heliopolis. This was the area that he was in. This was the area that he was selling grain to the world from. Where all of those roads seemed to come down and begin to intersect. All of those roads led to Joseph. And when his father, who's in Hebron, who's been forgotten by Joseph, set aside by Joseph. That is in my past, Joseph says. His father hears about there being grain in Egypt. And the brothers literally are sitting around. They're sitting around and staring at each other, is the picture in Scripture. They're sitting around with nothing to do, so they just would sit and stare. And Jacob says, why are you just sitting here? Go get us some food. And he sends them on their way. And you can see the train about to collide in an extraordinary chain of events. And by the way, I should note here, in chapter 42, verse 4, when he sends 10 of the brothers down to Egypt, verse 4, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin. This is Joseph's younger brother that almost certainly he has never met. He did not send Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, I am afraid that harm may befall him. It's been 20, 21 years since Joseph died in Jacob's mind. And in those 21 years, Jacob's perceptive mind has picked up what? That perhaps his death was not so accidental. Perhaps the brothers had something to do with it. And while he believes that he was torn to pieces, while he believes that he is dead, he also believes that Benjamin is safer at home than with his older brothers, who, by the way, now extend all the way up into their 50s, perhaps even into their 60s. And he sends them down to get food. In an extraordinary, amazing, literally, like a shocking turn of events. If you read this without a knowledge of what is going to happen, if you try to place yourselves just playing it out like a novel, this is an unbelievable story. In an amazing turn of events, Joseph's brothers come to Joseph. They could have gone to so many places. But Joseph is overseeing the sale of grain to foreigners. And so they come to Joseph to purchase grain for the family in verse 6. They don't recognize Joseph. Last they saw him, he was 17 years old, begging for his life. And now how old is he? 38. Now I'm 39 years old. And I look at pictures of me at 17. And I have gotten much wider since then. And I would imagine that this happens to other people. And it probably happened to Joseph. Plus, Joseph looks like an Egyptian. We've covered that in previous weeks. He speaks Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian. He's got an Egyptian wife. I mean, for all intents and purposes, what is Joseph? Egyptian! And so they show up to buy food and they do not recognize him. And the brothers bow down. What does that remind you of? Look at verse 9. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he had had about them. And he says to them, you are spies. You've come to look at the undefended parts of our land. It's hard to tell whether Joseph really believes this or not, although it is most probable that he did not actually genuinely believe that they were spies. Rather, he was putting them to the test. See, God had tested Joseph to find out what was in his character, in order to produce trust and patience. And Joseph now puts his brothers to the test. But it sucks the air out of your lungs when you're reading this. I hope when you read Scripture, you are gripped by what is going on. It's such a rotten, stinking thing that we know the end of the story. It's such a bummer that you know what's going to happen. I wish I could take you and erase what you know about the next few chapters from your head. Because you would be shocked at how gripping it is to read this as it is playing out. You literally are gripped with this idea. Joseph was reamed by his brothers. He's been through hell for 21 years. Just recently he's been raised up to this position of power. And he's had these kids, and he's named them names to say, I forget about my past. I put my past behind me. God is good. I'm moving on. And now, his past has come back, and there they are. The 10 brothers who he last saw gathered around the top of the pit. The 10 brothers who sold him into slavery. There they are. And what are they doing? They're bowing down to me. Here is Joseph in the ultimate reversal. He is now the one in a position of power. And his 10 brothers don't even know who he is. He could hammer on them and they wouldn't even know that it was coming. What an unbelievable position of power. What a great opportunity. Wouldn't you sit there and just go, God, did you give this to me so I could ruin their lives? You know? Wouldn't you be tempted? Wouldn't you taste it on your lips? Wouldn't you thirst to get them back? I think of how I treat my wife and my children and my friends. How much more? How much more negatively would I want to treat someone that had done me such pain, taken me away from the Father that I loved? All of these things 21 years earlier. What will Joseph do? At first, it seems he's going to throw him into jail as revenge. But then, when one of the brothers speaks up, Joseph learns that his father is alive and that he has a brother. And Joseph begins to explore, what is going on with these brothers of mine? Are they still the same evil group who killed him in cold blood? And I put killed in parentheses. To them, he is dead. They thought that they had sold him off and that now he is gone. He is as good as dead. To his father, he is dead. And remarkably, they don't show up again in the text until he considers them dead and gone. See, there's a death that has occurred in the family. And it's Joseph. And now Joseph is back. Resurrected, if you will, into the text. And he comes back and he is testing them to see if they have changed. Joseph must find out what these guys are made of. What has happened in the last 21 years? Trust must be rebuilt. What of their character? Who have they become in these past 21 years? And so the games begin. Joseph begins to press in on them at first that they're spies. And it begins an elaborate cat and mouse game between he and his brothers, with Joseph attempting to reconnect with the brother he doesn't know and the father that he had long forgotten. He stands next to his brothers as they begin to talk to one another in Hebrew. They don't know that he can understand what they're saying, that he remembers his native tongue. He's probably teaching it to Ephraim and to Manasseh, his own children. He wants them to know that they are Hebrews. He's named them by Hebrew names. He understands what his brothers are saying. I love these verses. I'm going to pick it up in verse 21. Follow along if you will. Chapter 42, verse 21. His brothers are talking and it says, they said to one another, truly, we are guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us. Yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has now come upon us. What do they see? A God of retribution. You messed with Joseph. You ruined his life. And now they believe God's going to ruin theirs. You ever feel like that? You ever feel like, you know, you've done evil in your life? And so when bad things happen, what do you say? I deserve this. I've been a bad person. I've got bad things in my history. Is that what's going on here? Perhaps God is refining them with this test. Perhaps God is pressing in on them the extent of their sin against their brother. But look at what happens next. Verse 22. Reuben, remember Reuben is the oldest, answered them saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. What did Joseph just discover? That Reuben tried to save his life. After all these years, he just found out what we've known for the past 21 years. That Reuben, his oldest brother, tried to save him. And Reuben says, now comes the reckoning for his blood. They did not know, however, that Joseph understood. Why? There was an interpreter between them. Joseph was clever. He brought someone in that knew Egyptian and Hebrew just like he did. And he had him stand there. And he had him interpret. How awesome is that? I mean, Joseph just stands there and listens. And they just spill their guts. And what is he learning? They've got regret. And Reuben wasn't responsible. So who's the next oldest in the family? Simeon. And so who does he grab? Simeon. He gets Simeon and he binds him in front of his brothers. And he throws him in jail. And he says, if you ever want to see your brother again, then you need to go back to your home, taking the provisions that I've given to you, and you need to go back and bring your youngest brother to me. See, he wants to see Benjamin for himself. He wants to reconnect with his youngest brother. He wants to have a relationship with him. And so he takes Simeon, the one that was the oldest and would have been most responsible for selling him into slavery, and he throws him in jail. And he sends his brothers back home. And on their way home, they open their sacks, and what do they discover? That the money that they had paid for the grain with had been put back into the mouth of their sacks. And they are terrified. They actually say, what is God doing to us? That this evil is happening around us. How could this be? This man is holding our brother hostage. And now it appears that we have stolen the money that came with the grain. And they get back to their father Jacob and they explain the whole story. And they say, we got to take Benjamin. And what does Jacob say? No way! You're not taking Benjamin back. The last time I sent one of my sons off, he ended up getting killed. You're not taking Benjamin. And so they use up all of the grain. Think about the time that's involved there. 10 sacks, well, probably 9 sacks. Maybe they gave him a sack for Simeon, but 9 sacks of grain for sure. And they use up all of that grain. And when they're getting down to the very end of their supplies, Jacob says, we've got no choice. We've got no choice. I'm going to have to send Benjamin back with you. And Reuben swears, he says, you can take my two oldest. You can take my two oldest kids and kill them. I will bring you Benjamin back. I promise you. Reuben, the oldest son, says. And so Jacob sends off. Jacob, who is very old by this time, sends off his youngest son, watches him ride off and head back down towards Egypt. And the cat and mouse game continues. Joseph sees from a distance that Benjamin and his family are coming. Number 4, letter A. Joseph has a large meal prepared in chapter 43, right around verse 16. Joseph saw Benjamin with them and he said to the house steward, bring the men into the house, slay an animal and make it ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon today. So high noon arrives in Egypt and out comes Joseph. And he shows unbelievable insight into the family. This is one of the greatest passages. It's so clever, the way that Joseph reveals himself. Look at verse 27. They've gone back and forth, and now they've determined that someone in Egypt knew about the money thing, because that was the first thing they wanted to get cleared up. So they've got everything cleared up. And in verse 27, Joseph comes out, and there's this big meal prepared, and he walks in, and it says, then he asked them about their welfare. And what's the first thing he wants to know about? His father. Is your old father well of whom you spoke? Is he still alive? What you, I believe, are hearing there is the emotion of a son who hasn't seen his dad in 21 years. And when he last left him, he was intimately connected. Remember, he was Jacob's favorite. And he misses his father. He's had time now to contemplate what is happening around him. Verse 28, they say, your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive. And they bowed down. There they are again, bowing down in homage to him. He lifted his eyes and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, his brother Benjamin. And he said, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke? May God be gracious to you, my son. Joseph's emotion is such that he hurries out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother, and he sought a place to weep, and he entered his chamber, and he wept there. And then he washed his face, and he came out, controlling himself, and said, serve the meal. And look at the insight that he shows into this family. These guys would have been freaking out at this next scene. All right? This would have been so spooky to them. So they served him by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for it is loathsome to the Egyptians. So the family is over here, Joseph is over here, and the native Egyptians are over here. Now, Joseph's family wouldn't have understood why they were being separated like that, but Joseph knew that he was not an Egyptian, so he was not eating with the Egyptians, but it just looked like a position of respect to the brothers. The Egyptians knew that it was loathsome to them to eat with Semites or anybody from the land of Canaan. So they were separated out. And so that's why they know that they're separated from Joseph. And the brothers just understand they don't want to eat with us because they're Egyptians and we're not. What does it communicate to them though? Joseph is not one of us. He's one of them. And he's just in a position of respect, so he's being served individually. So the ruse continues. Now they were seated, verse 33, before him, before Joseph. The firstborn, according to his birthright. So who do they sit down first? Reuben. Then Simeon. And right down the line, all the way to Benjamin. The youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at each other in astonishment. Can you imagine? The guy calls out the names. Reuben, you're here. Simeon, you're here. Levi, you're here. So on, all the way down. Benjamin, you're last. You're right here. What would the brothers have done as they saw this play out? This is exactly our birth order. How could anybody know that? How could anybody know the kinds of insights that this guy has? They would have been so spooked. This would have freaked them out. It says they were in astonishment at what was taking place. He took portions to them from his own table, did Joseph. But Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. He shows favoritism towards his brother. So they feasted and they drank freely with Joseph. This meal would have placed in their minds that they were dealing with a power far, far beyond what they were used to. And in a final dramatic test, letter B, number 4, Joseph sends all of his brothers home. But he conspires. He finds a way to keep Benjamin in his presence. There's a sense here that perhaps Joseph just wants to play out his days with Benjamin. Perhaps Benjamin is the one that he is seeking. Except, we have that nugget in the back of our mind that he is deeply in love with his father Jacob. And that he wants to draw Jacob from Canaan up to or over to Egypt at some point. And so how can he do that? He will keep this son, his favorite, alive. And he will keep him in Egypt. And that will do what? That will draw Jacob down from Canaan and bring him to Egypt. And then the family in Joseph's mind, the proper family, will be reunited once again. And the test that he devises is clever. He gives them all provision for the road. He puts the sacks of grain onto their beasts. And in verse 2 of chapter 44, it says, "Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain." And the steward did as Joseph had told him. As soon as it was light, the men were sent away, they with their donkeys. They had just gone out of the city and were not far off when Joseph said to his house steward, "Now, follow the men. And when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks?'" And he's talking of the cup here. He's saying, the cup has been stolen. The cup that you people have stolen, is it not the one that my Lord drinks from? Is it not the one that he indeed uses for divination? You have done wrong in doing this. Now, a lot of us get hung up on, whoa, divination. Like, that's like witchcraft. That's, you know, that's some kind of weird thing. And Joseph had a cup that was dedicated for this use. This is one of two things. Either Joseph was practicing some of the practices of Egypt, which I don't entirely object to. I'm not saying that he never, you know, that he was perfect or that he never did anything wrong. Or Joseph had one of these cups because it was just simply the custom for officials in Egypt. We know for sure from Joseph's own mouth and his own testimony that he relied on God for whatever insights that he had. We know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. So just the mention of a cup of divination, don't get too caught up on it. But the fact was that it was common for these officials to have these. And the fact was that stealing a cup of divination, the silver cup, would have been a huge crime. And simply put, even the Hebrews knew the significance of that cup. Even the Hebrews would have known, you can't steal that. You can't take that. That would be wrong. So the house steward catches up. He explains the situation, and we pick it up in verse 11. The brothers hurried. Each man lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. I love verse 12. It's quite dramatic. Those of you that are drama kings and queens, you're going to love this. He searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. Can you imagine it playing out? They go to Reuben's sack, and they open it up. Then they go to Simeon, and they open it up. And then they work their way down, and the brothers are finally like, oh, thank goodness. Oh, we're off the hook. We're off the hook. And then they go to Benjamin's sack. Whoosh, open it up. They reach down into the sack, and woo! Out comes the silver cup. Verse 13. Then they, the brothers, tore their clothes. And when each man loaded his donkey, they returned to the city. They were devastated. Of all the brothers to have the silver cup, who had it? Benjamin. The one guy in the family that we promised would come home. The one guy. And what had they promised? They had promised this. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there, verse 14. And they fell to the ground. And Joseph said, what is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination? So he's playing the role. He's playing it up. And Judah said, what can we say? How can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are your slaves, both us and the one with whom you found the cup. Verse 17, the worst thing those brothers had ever heard. Far be it from me, Joseph says, to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. As for the rest of you, hey, go in peace to your father. Joseph must have just been loving this. This is the moment he's been looking for. This is the ultimate test. Are they going to ditch their younger brother the way they ditched him? Are they going to treat him the same way that he had been treated? Are they going to make up some lie to tell the dad again to get out of what's going on here? Are they going to hide, lie, cheat, and steal like they did 21 years earlier? It's the perfect storm. And those brothers are caught dead in the middle of it. You got to love the Bible. You got to just love that God and His hand are what orchestrated these things. Don't miss. No man could have thought this up. This is God at work. Someone, some youth pastor of mine a long time ago said, whenever you see coincidence in Scripture, just know that's just the fingerprints of God. There are no coincidences in the Bible. And there are no coincidences in your and my lives either. Those are just the fingerprints of God. He is at work in our lives. And the story of Joseph vividly depicts this for us. I think in one of the more profound sections of Scripture are these verses that start in verse 18 and extend all the way to verse 34. Do you remember that when Joseph was sold into slavery, that they were going to kill him before that? They threw him down in the pit and they were planning on just chopping him up. And taking his coat and dipping it in his own blood and taking it back to his father. Do you remember that they were going to kill him? And who stepped up? Who stepped up to say, why don't we sell him? Like, why should his blood be on our hands? Who stepped up to say that? Judah. Do you remember why that was significant? Because Judah is, and we will know this from chapters that come up in front that are still coming, that the scepter is going to, in other words, the place of authority, the royal kingly part of this family that belongs to Jacob, is going to continue into history through the line of Judah. That Judah is called the lion of the family. And that the lion of Judah will come many generations in the future in the person of Jesus Christ. So, where did Joseph receive his redemption from? Remarkably, in the midst of all that evil, he receives it from Judah. And I think that that's profound. Because Judah is providing salvation for Joseph. And now we see some of the fruitfulness and the end result of some of that salvation that has come. It's now looped back around to the family. And what do we find here? Who steps up to say something in verse 18? Then Judah approaches him. And what does Judah say? He says, "My Lord, I am your servant, and I need to tell you a little story. See, this son belongs to this mother, and his other brother got killed, and his father is deeply connected to him, and it was a real risk to even bring him down here, and if we don't take him back, it is going to wipe Dad out. He will surely die if we do not return him." And I want you to see what Judah says down in verse 33. This is Judah, and it's at the end of what he has to say. "Now, therefore," he sums up everything that he has said, "now, will you please do this? Please let your servant," he's speaking of himself. Judah is talking of his own life, his own person. He says, "Now, please let your servant remain instead of the lad. I will be your slave. Let the lad go." Judah wants to substitute his life for Joseph's life. For Benjamin's life. He wants to substitute the pain that is going to come upon Benjamin that he perceives, and he wants to substitute his own life for that. Verse 34, "For how shall I go back to my father if the lad is not with me? How could I return? I cannot. Please, if you have any mercy in your soul, let my life count for his. Let him go, and I will stay." There are very few verses in Scripture that prefigure out of this line of Judah who Jesus Christ will be. That Jesus Christ steps into your and my life, and rather than make you pay the price for the sin that you and I have participated in, Jesus Christ steps in and says, No. I will take your place. Just let me take your place. It'll be a substitute. My life for your life," Jesus Christ says. "You get all the things that Jesus would get, freedom and a return to the family. And what does Jesus get? He gets all the punishment that you and I deserve. This was the offer that Judah was making for his brother's life. And this is the offer that would come through the line of Judah eventually to you and I through Jesus Christ. Judah wants to substitute his life for his youngest brother. And what does Joseph see there? These guys have changed. They've been transformed. They're not like they used to be. These 21 years have done us all some good. He sees changed hearts and a father's abiding love for his children. And in a vivid passage, and it would not be just for me just to tell you about it, so I will read it in starting in verse 1 of chapter 45. "Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, 'Have everyone go out from me, except for the brothers.' So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?'" Because he doesn't know if they're telling the truth. "I am Joseph." Now just imagine being on the brothers' end of things. You're looking at an Egyptian who speaks Egyptian, and you've been having all these problems with him, and he says, "I am Joseph." What are you thinking? What?
What did he just say? Do you think he's right? What? Joseph. How does he even know that name? Did somebody say Joseph? Did somebody refer to our dead brother? Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers couldn't answer him. They were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said in verse 4, please come close. Look at me. And they came closer and he said, I am your brother Joseph, who you sold into Egypt. And he begins to reveal the story. Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And in two of, I think, more redemptive verses in all the Bible, verses 7 and 8, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant. A remnant. Jacob and his family. God sent me here to preserve you, the remnant, in the earth, and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but it was God. And He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. There's good reason to believe that the Pharaoh that instituted the plan with Joseph has died, and his son, Sesostris II, has come to power, and that he was very young. And what would that leave Joseph in? A position of unbelievable influence to all of Egypt. A position where a very young Pharaoh was leading. A position where the guy that was dad's right-hand man is kind of in charge. And so he says to his brothers, God has made me a father to Pharaoh. Unbelievable, this story. The way that Judah steps in, and the way that we will see that in his family eventually. There's so much here. I shudder to think where we should land this morning. But I'd like to invite the worship team to come up because I'd like us to unpack this in our own lives privately. And I wrote myself this note. This is the question that I've been asking myself as I've been studying Joseph's life. And I ask it of you this morning. Have you placed your life? Have you placed the old hurts and grudges and situations of your life, past pains that might run very deeply in your soul, things that are very difficult for you to even walk through and remember because they are that painful for you? Have you placed these things into God's hands? Do you see God's hands in the actions that maybe happened to you when you were even a young child? Do you see God's hands in the midst of your life? See, God's hand was in the midst of that. Even in the most extreme of situations, God's hand is in the midst of it. He is at work. He is kingly, sovereign over all people, everywhere. And His hand is at work in our midst. Do you agree? Do you recognize that? Could you say with Joseph, man has not done this to me. I see God here. God has done this to provide things for me that I could not have obtained through any other route. And in Joseph's case, he's sharing that now with his brothers. He's sharing that with the world that is around him. Do you believe that his plans are better? That his ways are best? Will you trust in him for these tender areas of your life this morning? Take time to pray to the Lord. Take time to do business with Him this morning. As we sing together, don't miss this time to unpack these sensitive areas of your life, for me, with my life, with the Lord. Let's stand and sing together.